Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to another episode of Dark Reading Radio. I'm Sarah Peters, Senior Editor here at Dark Reading, and I will be one of your hosts for today's show where we will discuss, what else, the Sony hack. If this is your first time to Dark Reading Radio, I want to direct your attention to the live text chat that's happening beneath your radio player. Chat's already happening now. It'll go on throughout the show, and at 1:30 Eastern Time, Tim Wilson, our editor-in-chief, and our two wonderful guests, and I will all head over to the chat where you can pepper the guests with your own burning questions directly. That will go on until 2 o'clock, so please don't be shy. It's a group of very nice people. Dive right in and ask your questions now. With that, I'm going to pass it on over to Tim Wilson, editor-in-chief. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Sarah. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm just grand. Thank you.
Well, we're excited to have a couple of great guests here today. We've been, you know, as I can imagine, and I know Sarah has been writing feverishly on the whole topic of Sony.
Good word for it.
You haven't seen it on Dark Reading. I'm sure you've seen it other places. You've probably talked about it over the water cooler. You know, Sony is sort of a bellwether for a lot of reasons, because of the type of attack it was, because of the impact it had, because it had some consumer, you know, impact. Got talked about in a lot of places, and even in the State of the Union last night, we saw, you know, President Obama really, you know, focusing in on cybersecurity and, you know, issues of privacy and, you know, so on and so forth. So it seems like a turning point in, you know, the conversation, and that's why, you know, Dark Reading wanted to do a radio segment on it. We're privileged to have with us a couple of very interesting guys, not only smart security guys, but just interesting people today. We have our first guest is George Kurtz. He's the CEO and co-founder of CrowdStrike, which is a company you probably know. They're a leading provider of next-generation endpoint protection threat intelligence and services. One of the things that they do really well is track the groups, the various threat actor groups that are out there in the world, and understand their behavior and the way that they work and that sort of thing. So George will hopefully be able to talk to us a little bit about how and why some of these organizations do what they do. He's also an internationally recognized author and entrepreneur. You might have heard of him when he was with McAfee. He was the worldwide CTO and GM. And prior to joining McAfee, he started Foundstone, which is another company that that a lot of us know and had experience with. You know, he's also been quoted in many publications. He's been on broadcast TV. He's been, and he was one of the authors of the best-selling security book of all time, which is Hacking Exposed: Network Security Secrets and Solutions. So, hi, George. How you doing?
Hi, Tim. Doing great. Thank you.
Our other guest is Neil Mueller. He's an executive at Shape Security, which is a company that, if you haven't taken a look at it, you should take some time and check them out. They're a new company funded by Kleiner and Google Ventures. They're in stealth mode right now, developing a new class of web security products. Previously, he led product launches at VMware and Cisco, and including the Nexus 1000V and VMware's vCloud suite. Both of these products pioneered new categories, and both created more than $100 million in their first year of sales. I'll say just on the side that both of these guys also have interesting personal lives. George, if we get a chance, we'll talk about the race car circuit. George is very involved in that. And Neil is an adventurer. He's climbed the seven summits, including Mount Everest, and unguided in 2005, and swum the English Channel in 2008, and rode across the Arctic Ocean in 2012. So if we run out of stuff to talk about on Sony, we'll definitely have other things to talk about. So hi, Neil, how you doing?
Hey, I'm great. How are you?
Good. I'm going to start out with a real basic question, and recognizing that maybe nobody but Sony has a real grip on what happened there. But to the extent that you can you talk about we went through a whole range of emotions when the attack happened. Who attacked them and who basically stole the data. Was it North Korea? At first there was a big wave and everyone said it was North Korea, and then right at the end there was sort of a backlash that sort of, where people were saying, well, I don't think it was North Korea. What can we say definitively about who did it and how they did it? I don't know if George, do you have any sort of general thoughts on that?
Sure, I'll just give you my general comments on this. And if you look at how this unfolded and kind of the timeline, obviously everyone was at the edge of their seat trying to figure out who this was. And really, in an unprecedented move, the U.S. government came out and said it was North Korea. We also looked at we did our analysis of the malware and concluded that it shared there was a lot of similarities to other piece of malware that were related to North Korea in prior attacks, and the TTPs related to this look very similar to what we've seen in the past. And I will caveat that by saying, there's no absolute in attribution. And I think, there's a lot of folks who are speculating and trying to sort out, who it was an insider, et cetera. But the mere fact that the U.S. government came out very strongly and said it was North Korea, including the FBI, they don't obviously take this lightly in being able to do that. And then, as you've seen over the last couple of weeks, just recently there was an article in the New York Times that indicated that the U.S. government had access to North Korean computers via the NSA, which really added an additional layer of certainty, at least on the part of the U.S. government, as to who it was. From my perspective, we did our analysis. We've got a blog on it. There's a lot of people who speculate. The U.S. government has lots of resources and smart people. And again, if they're coming out and saying this, then I think there's a high probability that it is North Korea. Unfortunately, in this case, there's no Ray Rice video. Two people come in the elevator and one person comes out. Like, I don't know that we're going to see the video of what happened here. But I think there's good certainty given what we've seen. But again, listeners and folks in the security community should realize that this is a bit of an art and science in terms of figuring out who is actually behind it.
Neil, do you have any thoughts on that? If not on attribution, what the methods were that were used?
So there were FBI reports that came out in mid December. Those are worthwhile taking a look at. You get to see it right from the horse's mouth. And then there's that most recent New York Times article that came out 3 days ago that talks about and adds some color to the FBI reports and talks about the beacons that were installed as early as 2010. So this predates both recent Sony breaches. There was a Sony breach in 2012, and then there was this most recent Sony breach. And there's evidence that there were beacons installed trying to drill into North Korea's network as early as 2010 by our federal government. And so that's interesting to know that we might have had a window into it for the last 5 years that the rest of the world might not have had. George mentioned this. What's unprecedented about this most recent news article is is not a breach like this. That's precedented. But what's unprecedented is that our federal government decided to attribute the cause of it to a specific government. That's never happened before. Obama has never come out, nor any of his predecessors, and blamed a specific country for an attack. That was unprecedented. I'm curious to see what that means for worldwide diplomacy, as cybersecurity all of a sudden becomes something that presidents are talking about.
Sarah, I don't want to hog all the questions, but while you're waiting to ask your first one, let me just follow up and ask. When we talk about, we all agree that attribution is tough, but we have some stuff to work with here. We have the government actually saying that it happened. What about motivation? Can we say for sure, what the motivation was? I mean, was it the movie, the interview that they were upset about, and that was the instigation, or is it something that really is? Is that really a side product of all of this? Do either one of you have a thought on that?
Yeah, sure. I'll jump in. I think it's hard to really understand motivation. If you look at the macro level, it's easy to say, well, geez, there was a movie that assassinated the leader of North Korea, and given the way the North Koreans operate, they were offended by that and want to use any means possible. But again, the motivations may be different. If you look at what happened here, not only was there destruction that took place, but there was also embarrassment, and really I think what we've seen over the last year now, particularly with this incident, is in the beginning, the adversaries were focused on network exploration. Let's get in and look around. Then they moved to data exfiltration. Well, geez, if we're in there, we can steal a bunch of stuff, whether it's valuable PII or whether it's intellectual property. And then we can move that one step further. We can actually burn the house down and destroy the data. But in the interim, they actually, given all of the sensitive information that they leaked, they certainly try to embarrass, Sony. So the motivations can be all over the board, and I think it's, speculation at this point. It's easy to say, well, it was because of the movie. Again, I'm not sure that we're really ever going to figure out the exact motivations behind it. But, at a macro level, it's easy to fall into the trap of, well, geez, it was because of the movie.
Right.
Neil, do you have anything to add on that?
I do. Let me take a little different take than George did on the question. So what motivated them to breach Sony systems? That's an interesting question. I think it's also interesting to look on the other flip side of it, as in, were they successful? So the hackers, whoever they are, were able to breach a lot of information. They also made a movie that may have otherwise not been very successful, incredibly successful, through an interesting effect called the Streisand effect. So listeners might know the Streisand effect. Barbara Streisand has this like beachfront property. This was years ago. And there was a picture of it on the internet. And to try to get rid of that picture on the internet, her lawyers filed takedown requests, and the world got a hold of that, and all of a sudden was really interested. And this picture that had been viewed like four times, once by Streisand herself, and then twice, three times by her lawyers, all of a sudden gets viewed by millions of people. You can Google it right now and see the picture. It's a nice house. So the Streisand effect is used to describe things when you try to bury them that actually become much bigger than if you hadn't tried to bury them at all, like the movie, which is at the top of the page on, my Apple TV, probably everyone else's too. Many of us have probably seen it only because they wanted to be a part of a news story. The movie itself might actually not be that good, but it's interesting to see that if that was their objective to bury this movie, they weren't successful in doing that. They did breach a lot of stuff from Sony. They were successful there, but not in the movie.
Well, now on that topic, we talk a lot about attribution, about what the motivation is, but it seems like there could be the motivated party, which let's say it is the nation-state actors in North Korea. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it was their people carrying out the attack, right? So do you guys feel like they might have hired a group of more financially motivated hackers to carry this whole mess out? Do you think that an insider was involved? Or do you think that this was all owned, operated, funded by the same group of people? George?
Well, yeah, this is George. Again, it's one of those areas, part art, part science. I don't know that we're ever going to find out. And what we've seen in the past, if you look at groups in China, and we spent a lot of time on our intelligence team tracking various groups in China, various campaigns, and there is a loose affiliation with the PLA. In some cases, it's a PLA. In other cases, it's a loose affiliation. People are moonlighting. They're part of the PLA, but they're moonlighting. So it becomes very murky to say definitively, okay, it was in fact the North Korean government and only them, just because of how these sort of events unfold. And if they don't have a particular skill set or they need access, I mean, you can go out and buy access to various places just depending on, you know, what botnets might have been deployed there, just, you know, as part of a broader campaign. And you can do that. And you can leverage skill sets in other areas if you needed to. So to be able to say it was definitively one party versus another party or, you know, was there help, hard to say, and I think speculation.
Yeah.
Now, one of the comments that you made was in an insider. And, you know, I've seen various vendors talk about this and, you know, basically say, well, geez, it must have been an insider because they've had access to passwords and they had access to certificates and, you know, they knew how to move around the network and et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, well, yeah, that's how a targeted attack works. So, again, is there insider help? Don't know. But the mere fact that they knew their way around the network, they had tools that were compiled specifically for the network, and they had passwords, is certainly not indicative of it just being an insider attack. That's how targeted attack works. In most cases, a targeted attacker knows the network better than your own people. So, you know, at the end of the day, it does make for a nice discussion, but, you know, given what happened and how it unfolded, it certainly doesn't mean it was an insider, you know, just given the level of information that they had. It's very easy to get that as an outsider.
Yeah, that's what I've heard from other people as well, even though my first instinct was, how could they possibly know all that without having some insider involved? But the more I talk to smart people like you about it, the clearer it seems to be that they don't necessarily need to have had an insider involved.
Sorry,
go ahead, George.
No, I was just going to say, Sarah, we investigate a lot of these large breaches, and it really is amazing on how quick and efficient they are in getting in, knowing the network, getting credentials, and moving around. And I sort of make the joke, you know, it takes a new employee about a month to figure out their way around the network and the internet. I mean, it takes these guys about 10 minutes to sort out what's going on, you know, and they've got enough time to do the reconnaissance maybe behind the scenes. Once they get in, I mean, they're very efficient about moving around. So what happened here is not out of the norm of what a target attack looks like.
Gotcha. Anil, did you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, so we have a unique opportunity today with George on the phone. So he just brought up the concept of credentials. I thought it might be interesting to postulate on, you know, exactly where this breach began. So what we do know, based on the New York Times article from a couple of days ago, is that it was caused by a zero-day attack. They haven't told us what kind. Now, George sees more of these than a lot of people. Before I ask him the question, so in 2012, we do know that the Sony breach had a lot of overlap in the accounts that were breached with the Gawker breach that happened at the same around the same time. And so people postulate that the breach was caused by taking usernames and passwords from, you know, PasteBin or other user stores that were breached, spilled credentials, that is, and testing them on Sony's site to see if they'll work. And a good portion of them worked. This kind of attack is called credential stuffing. You stuff the credentials into the website to see if they work, and 1% or 0.1% or 0.01% work, and then all of a sudden you have access to Sony's databases. Sometimes you have access to user accounts, other times you have access to admin accounts. That's how the Sony breach in 2012 happened. I wonder if we think that was the same way that it happened, or if it was a different kind of zero-day attack.
That's interesting. Kim, I monopolized some of the conversation there. Why don't you jump in?
I'm curious if, George, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, typically what we normally see is it's some level of spear phishing, whether it's malicious attachments or malicious links. And, you know, I was just sitting with a customer today, and they were talking about how they go through their spear phishing exercise and, you know, try to train people and look for who's clicking on stuff. I mean, they literally send an attachment that's zipped and password protected with the password, and it's an executable inside, and they tell people, you know, hey, you have to open this thing up and run it for whatever reason, you know, there's a document or something in there, and people just blindly do it. So the ability to get someone to actually execute what most of us in the security space would look at and say, you know, there's no way I would ever run that thing, is actually very easy, even if it's not a zero day. I mean, simply executing some malicious code that doesn't have necessarily zero day exploits in it is very easy to do. So in most cases, most companies around the planet, it is not hard to get an initial foothold into an organization. And then generally what happens from there is, as Neil mentioned, the credential theft. You know, once you're inside, it's trivial to dump, using a tool like Mimikatz, dump the credentials, even get Kerberos golden tickets, and you pretty much own the network in about 10 minutes. I mean, that's how easy it is. And in most organizations, the way they've set everything up, they really don't have a lot of protection against that. Neil made a great point about credential theft, and one of the biggest areas that we see is the fact that people reuse the same passwords across different websites and different areas. So if you look at the data breaches that are out there, you can be an employee of one company, but you know there's some banking site that you use, or you know, probably not a banking site, they're generally in better shape, but you know, some place, user form or something that you log into, if all those credentials get dumped, it's very easy for the adversary to go out and get those. And, oh, by the way, you happen to register that with your corporate address, and then you can make a match, and then you can begin to try to log in with those credentials. So there's a number of ways to get in, and generally they're pretty easy.
Let me just couch this then recognizing too that as these radio shows go so fast, and I have some really just starting to ask questions, but we only have about 8 minutes to go in our live portion. Are there lessons from what happened that a security professional can take away, you know, and say, you know, well, I'm going to do this, you know, to make sure that this doesn't happen to me? Or is this just the simple case of a targeted attack that was, you know, well put together and, you know, really there wasn't a whole lot that could be done, you know, in advance? I mean, as reporters, we get stuff from vendors all the time saying, well, we could have, you know, if they'd had our stuff, it would have,
okay.
You know,
it never would have happened.
And things like that. But really, from, you know, I mean, you guys are experienced in this stuff. Were there any lessons that we learned here, or is this just the case of, you know, a very motivated attacker with very sophisticated means, and there was really nothing they could do?
Well, let's postulate for a moment that the same thing that caused this most recent breach, the same type of attack, is what caused the attack back in 2012. So let's assume for a moment that's true. what we do notice is that Sony's website doesn't have, anything that would prevent what we call account checkers. So an account checker is a type of tool that takes a bunch of credentials from another spilled database and checks them on Sony's site to see if it, you know, happenstantially, like George says, gets, you know, like, a credential that works from one site working on another one. We know that Sony's site doesn't have any more controls this year than it did back in 2012. So they could have implemented something like that. You know, there's lots of different sort of Turing test type controls that do a lot more than just like the standard throttling and reputation that you would see because Throttle's reputation aren't going to work anymore in a world of botnets. We see a lack of new controls on Sony's site, and certainly if they had new controls there, it may have provided at least an initial barrier, if not an ultimate protection. Flip side of that, it would be to say that even if there was a new control put in place on Sony's site, that the spear phishing attack that George mentioned, they would have, a determined adversary would have been able to get in to that if they would have been able to work around the control.
Yeah, so I guess if you look at what happened here, I don't think Sony is different than any other large Fortune 1000 company in that they've all had breaches, and there's certainly different maturity levels in companies in their life cycle and how they are able to identify, respond, and detect these sort of things. But in general, as I said earlier, it's very easy to get into an organization and breach a company, particularly if it's a large company. Use Fortune 1000 as an example. Now, one of the things that I think we should just recognize is the fact that a lot of the technologies out there, unfortunately, are focused on detecting malware. And in this particular case, assume that it was a spearfish or something and there was some malware that was dropped. Well, if it was a targeted attack, it was pretty much compiled and packaged up for Sony, so it's difficult to detect that with signatures. So, when I look at how these attacks happen and, the original question is what can people do, you have to understand that technologies will fail. You just don't want it to fail silently. And instead of just focusing on malware, you need to understand that there's an adversary behind that malware and that's creating it. And even if one piece of malware is detected, they're just going to create a new piece. So you need to understand who's behind it because they're not going to go away. So when you think about that, the company had AV, right? That wasn't going to work signature-based. Malware runs on the system. And this goes for any company. I'm not singling out Sony. If something is running, once it hits that machine, really there's only a few things that can be done. It's like chess. There's only 20 opening moves in chess called gambits. And that activity is something that people should be looking for. Credential theft, lateral movement, accessing of data. And assuming that the bad guys are getting in at some point, you want to prevent them from getting in, of course, but realizing that no technology is perfect, then you want to be able to contain them and identify their activity very quickly so that they can't exfiltrate data or destroy the network. So those are my overarching comments around just how you deal with this. You have to assume there will be a breach, prevent as much as you can, but if there is a breach, quickly look for what the bad guys are going to do, and that is a finite number of tasks and very repeatable.
But now, I would imagine that you kind of defend different attacks, different potential attacks differently, right? I mean, I think we're so focused oftentimes now on the financially motivated attackers who are just trying to slurp up all of your credentials and sell them someplace. But with attacks that are just purely destructive in nature, do you have to approach it differently, or do you just, like you suggested, look for a certain finite number of possible activities and just focus on that as opposed to worrying about the motivation?
Well, Sarah, in order to get to the point where you can actually destroy data, I mean, there's common what we call indicators of attack, IOAs, the kind of common attack patterns. You still have to get in, right? You still have to implant yourself, get access to the systems, and then deploy technology that will ultimately destroy those systems that you're focused on. Before you hit the go button and things start to blow up, those steps and techniques are very well known and repeatable. So you just need to focus on what the adversary is trying to do, because in order to set that whole attack up, it's going to look like a targeted attack that's ultimately stealing data. They're just going to the next step of then trying to destroy the system.
Gotcha. So again, it's focusing on those first steps before. If you're just really doing a good job of that, maybe we wouldn't get into these kinds of problems. Okay, everybody, we have only 1 minute left. So, Tim, do you have one final question for our guests that they can answer in 30 seconds or less?
Yeah, I'd like to invite the audience to stay for the the chat, there's an opportunity for you to ask questions directly of the speakers and go into more depth on some of the things that we're talking about here. Maybe the one question that Neil was reminding me of the 2012 Sony attacks, which actually I wrote about before I had Sarah, who does a much better job than I do. there were several attacks there, and one of the things that struck me was, how decentralized Sony is as a company, and both geographically and from a business perspective. And I guess I have two questions. One is a company like that that's very decentralized and has, sort of lots of entities all over the world, more at risk than, a very centralized type of organization? And maybe two is a company that's been breached before, that's had a nasty breach like that before, more likely to fall victim to it, again? I don't know if either one of you can, take either one of those questions.
Sure. This is Neil from Shape. So we just blogged today about a new attack tool that we have been finding out in the wild called Account Checkers. And we definitely postulate that big brands, whether they're decentralized or not, just big brands, Sony's one of the biggest brands in the world, they're definitely in the top 50, are definitely subject to account checkers like this more than others.
And I think, Tim, one of the real challenges that we see all the time is a mismatch in consistent security practices and policies, particularly in organizations that may be set up with lots of subsidiaries, which, they all look like it's the same company, but unfortunately it's not, and there's different levels of security. Or what we'll see is, and we get called in on this a lot, is a big company is buying another company, and from an M&A perspective, they're doing their due diligence, and they realize that the other company is totally owned, and they can't be connected to the network. So it's this inconsistent application of security that creates portal holes, if you will, which really allow the adversary to get in. And it's been a problem for many years. It will continue to be a problem, unfortunately, going forward.
Yeah, that's a really good topic, and I'm thinking about story ideas as we talk here. But okay, well, Sarah, it looks like we're at the bottom of the hour here, so it looks like I'll let you close out the audio portion, but let's keep talking online here.
Absolutely. Thank you all for joining us today, and like Tim said, stick around in the chat. We'll still be going until 2:00. Thank you again to George Kurtz and Neil Mueller for being wonderful guests, and we will see you next time.
Thank you.